Many of us know that herbal medicine was the main healthcare system in America only 100 years ago, and the Ayurvedic and Chinese systems of botanical medicine have an over 5,000-year history. Today, science can distill the physical properties, but the energetics of plants are key. So I was very excited to read the title of Kat Mayer's book, Energetic Herbalism. And today, she's here with us. Stay tuned. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Kat, I'd like to start with the ending of your book, Energetic Herbalism. Tell us about the chaparral in the desert. It's such a mind-blowing story, isn't it?
Oh my. You know, I love that. And Robin, that's so funny because I say, look, just to get started, start with the intro, chapter 3, Medicine of Place, and read the epilogue. So that's so funny. The story of the chaparral is the growth habit of chaparral. For those that don't know, it's a profound medicine that's been used for over 10,000 years. And we know that because as the story that you're calling forth is in the genotype, the way that chaparral grows is it grows in rings and it extends out from the original root. And so doing genotypes and exploration in the lab that way with the physiognomy of the plant, they suppose that this plant is 18,000 years old. And so for me, that story represents one is, you know, continuous use with native peoples. And still to this day, those in Mexico and New Mexico, this is such a profound healer for them, just with their whole ethnobotany, anthropology, you know, all the studies of this observational as versus this deep, deep relationship and the stories that the indigenous people have told, and then the stories that the plant has told. And so in this time of incredible uncertainty and how do we engage and where do we go? Why I ended with this story is, you know, these plants have an intelligence, a wisdom. They have survived and not only survived, but there's this thrival capacity to them. So to understand that this one plant has survived epochs is so important for us to understand because so much is anthropologically oriented these days. So let's look to those beings and those intelligences that have survived and how have they done that. For me, it's the story of hope. Everyone's using the word resilience these days, but you know, I also tell the story in the book about ginseng and how ginseng is what herbalists call an adaptogen. And the adaptogen, the term was coined by Russians who were looking for plants that would treat stress, would treat long-term adaptation to stress. And so when we ginseng and many of the different ginsengs are in that group, but, you know, they survived an ice age, you know, and they're rooted creatures. These are rooted beings. They can't move. They can't up and relocate. So their whole chemistry is all about morphing and changing and going deep into this place of resilience. And so when we take the ginsengs, we take these steroidal compounds and terpenoids and whatever the chemistry is, and they really help us adapt. But really looking at how these plants teach us, you know, we call plants allies these days, but for me, they do things I could never do.
Because our communication with plants is basically nonverbal, moving from thinking mind to perception is almost a given for you as an herbalist. Can you share an experience of this and why it's a key piece?
Thank you, Robin. Yeah, and I'm very grateful that this is getting more and more attention, both in education and different articles. And so part of this is really about developing relationship. And it's that essence, it's that being of that plant that somehow or another touched us and resonated. And we really can't explain why. And so one personal experience I had, and I shared this in the book, was with black cohosh. And I feel that the Appalachian Mountains and the plants have really been my teachers, and I had been going into the woods. This is the early 80s. I really didn't have herbal teachers, so I would just go into the forest, know the plants, be with the plants, and identify them. And so I was on my way returning to visit this one cohosh in hot July, because that's when the plume of this beautiful white flower is in bloom and so incredibly showy because it's attracting. It's all about sex, right? It's pollination. So it attracts us as well. I was turning the corner, and it was one of the first times I really felt this profound exchange. You know, I really felt that this energy, you know, leapt from the cohosh. And there's this term I talk about, aesthesis, where it takes the breath away. But what happens is there's this exchange of breath. And that's that, again, that falling in love, falling into this immediacy where you transcend thought, you transcend rationalism, and it's coming from your body. And so this is a really important way to begin to experience these plants in more of a sensual way. Some people say heart-centered. You can do it through a dream state, but it's this physicality of paying attention. It really calls forth that we pay attention and we become incredibly present. And that's in many ways where these plants will quote unquote speak to us. They're constantly there. We're learning in forest bathing that you just go in and our chemistry changes, our immune system changes. The cohosh story came about because I had gone and visited and spent time with it. And whenever you put time into a relationship, there are great fruits. And so that's one place where this relationship really took me then. And it gave me information. I gathered information about that plant. So there's many, many different forms that can be used today to access this information, but it's accessing information through our heart, through our senses, as versus simply the intellect.
Yes. Is there a brief pointer you can give us in doing what I believe you call sensory noticing, which sounds like what you've just been describing?
Sure. The essence of notification, where you're also notifying the plant that, you know, I would like to sit with you. I'd like to engage in this relationship. You know, for me, it can be as simple as sitting with a plant. I love to teach students to draw, and to draw realizing no one's going to look at this. To not have a judgment value of a good drawing or bad drawing. But what happens when you draw a plant, you really look at the venation and, wow, that really is a serrated or a toothed edge, or wow, look at that leaf, it's clasping. So the drawing of the plant really invites this intimacy, and you begin to enter into the phenomenon of the plant, really. If you feel safe, if you have identified, if you feel safe to taste the plant, because the flavor is so much of the medicine. It's also so much of the magic. Bitter flavors are to keep us away. Oh, this is a low dose botanical. So there's so much information in the flavor, but of course you have to properly ID the plant to know that it's safe. Oftentimes what I really say is give the plant thanks, give a plant, whether a hair, whether it's tobacco, it is an exchange. It'd be like if I met you for the first time and I went up and I said, oh, Robin, give me all this information. How rude that would be without saying, well, here, I'd love to give you a gift. I realize you're about to give me something. So let me honor your time and your information and your knowledge. So it is that exchange. It's what Robin Wall Kimmerer has been talking about, reciprocity. And this is just more than these words or these quotes that are out there. This is essential in order for the plant to show up for you later on in your apothecary.
I was going to ask you later, but you're leading us right into, and I quote from your book, "Gratitude is more than a polite thank you." recognition activates a place of responsibility. And when I read this, I thought, okay, now we're getting somewhere. It's very, very insightful and definitely a piece of the puzzle.
Yes, it is. And, you know, there's many, many herbalists for millennia that have been working in a more clinical or taking this herb or making this tea, or we read the eclectics and, you know, where this component, this engagement with the plant wasn't present, and yet the medicine still worked. So it isn't exclusive. And also, when we engage with that deep gratitude, the plants will show up in ways that go beyond their definitions, that go beyond, oh, this is a reproductive herb, or this is this herb. They are kaleidoscopic in their reach within our beings. I had one teacher who just said, psychedelics and hallucinogenics and entheogens, you don't need to go there. Every single plant has the ability to take you to these places.
It feels like it's a matter of not setting a limit, just as you go into any relationship, to be totally open. And then the magic can begin, right?
Yeah. But when you have this friend that's showing up for you, you show up and you become maybe larger than you normally are to really reach out to help this person because they have this way of gratifying, gratifying for what you're doing. So in some ways, that's what the plants are. They are so much more than we limit them to. So yes, you're exactly right there.
What do you mean by calling yourself a community-created herbalist?
So I love this story. You know, I'm a physician assistant and I went to medical school. I didn't want to go to full medical school because I knew I wanted the plants. But the language of medicine in the with majority of Americans is allopathy, and that's conventional medicine. So I really wanted to have that language to help people feel more comfortable entering into the natural world of plants and healing. And I came out, I didn't go to an herb school, was sort of self-taught. And what I did, it was, you know, early 80s, a massage wasn't even licensed, if you can believe it. So I lived in a rural county and we had a hustle. We were artists and creatives and we were hustling our livelihood. So I got a table, taught myself massage, and I lived in a very wealthy county with horses in Virginia. So during the morning, I would give massage, and then the afternoon, I would learn plants. And over 7 years, it took 7 years where I would slowly offer herbs and, you know, really studying them and did not pose as an herbalist, but deep, deep study. Then in 7 years, the community started saying, oh, go see the herbalist. In some ways, that really is the traditional way because you would become the midwife, you would become the herbalist when your herbs worked, when your births were safe. And so when I say community created, they literally began referring to me that way before I did.
That's wonderful. In synthesizing the many herbal traditions, what becomes obvious? And is there a danger of losing potency held by one tradition or another in combining traditions?
Thank you so much for that question, Robin, because what, and oftentimes people think that I am blending the Chinese and the Ayurveda and Greek or Western energetics. And I am not blending them together. What I'm doing is showing the commonality, and the commonality of all three is that they're working from the elements of the earth. And so we're looking at fire, water, air, ether, and Ayurveda. And why I love these elemental traditions is for people to really understand of their elements, their nature. And so my nature is in Ayurveda, if it's a constitution, I'm fiery. then I can make better choices. I can understand why I'm prone to certain things. I'm knowing my nature. And so each tradition takes the elements, and there's a lens on something very separate, but it helps us to learn, wow, Earth. Oh, Earth is late summer. It's our gardens. They're abundant. It's digestion. And then looking at, well, what does Earth mean? So as versus synthesis, it's taking traditions that give us tools, very specific tools, to help us engage in our health in a very elemental way.
Thank you. Kat, tell us about circling back to bioregionalism in your career.
Yeah, well, in that beginning time where I was in the woods and teaching myself, I was pretty radical bioregionalist in the 80s, and we were really coming into sustainability early on. And I would only work with plants that either grew in my bioregion or I lived on an organic farm. And there was the burdock, and there were just certain herbs there. And I had a very, very small repertoire. And I love what Suevo Brooks, a fabulous herbalist, says. True herbalist can work with 40 uses of one plant as versus 40 plants and one use. And so that's where I was. I had 12, maybe 15 herbs, and no matter who came through the door, I could work with them.
Right.
And
beautiful.
When you travel in Central America, you see that, you know, that's what they do. And then I would meet fabulous teachers and learn Ayurveda and TCM, Chinese medicine. And then my apothecary grew because you hear about these plants and they're phenomenal. And so as we've been watching what's happening with the climate, with endangered plants, I've really come down now and really taken up that mantle of bioregionalism again. And my feeling, Robin, is how wonderful that we can have great tools and really deeply know them before they're taken away, as best as we can, obviously, of the plants that are around us.
Is it difficult or straightforward to put plant extinction in perspective? Is there anything about it that you find or feel evidence of to some kind of cosmic agreement going on?
In the sense of the loss of plant species, that possibly there's this natural order to what's happening?
Yes.
That's the question, yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, we talk about invasives. You know, there's this huge right. debate going on with invasives. And, you know, native plant societies are vigilant and preserving the native medicines. And yet when we look at these invasives, kudzu, they call that the plant that's taking over the southeast.
Yes.
It's steroidal saponins. And so we have black cohosh, which is being pillaged out of our woods for menopause treatment. Kudzu is a substitute. You know, it has steroidal compounds. It's an analog. And so obviously it's this wide angle vision. And who is one generation to make a statement? I think what's most important is we're observing. And we're observing the reality and the terror that somebody is sitting there saying, oh, today we lost this number of species. To me, you know, that's beyond comprehension that so many are leaving. And at the same time, the Gaian hypothesis, Lovelock and Margiela's, is she is constantly readjusting, you know, the salinity of the ocean and the airs. And is there a cosmic, as you say, this balancing of bringing in plants like Japanese knotweed? You know, Lyme is an epidemic. So is Japanese knotweed, and it has incredible antioxidants, and it's a profound healer for Lyme. So I don't feel qualified or able to make a statement about that other than our work as an herbalist is to observe. President of United Plant Savers, I am deeply committed to working with these medicines that are leaving. In the sense of the pollinators, in the sense of the base foundation of how many other species are dependent on them. At the same time, to try to maintain an intact ecosystem, I believe that ship has sailed, and also to understand there is a grace that's happening.
Oh, absolutely.
And let's look at who's moving in.
Yeah. You give specific information for 25 herbs in your book. Is there a 26th that just missed your cut?
Oh, there's another 25. And it was so incredibly challenging, Robin. That was like one of the hardest things in the book. You know, I might say holy basil. I might say the oxymum species. And why I would pick holy basil, it's an annual. But the majority of the herbs that I chose, you can grow in Arizona, you can grow in Oregon, and they are growing. They're what we call the colonizer plants. They moved west, they spread, and some of them are considered invasives, but they're accessible. Anybody can go get mullein. Holy basil, anyone can grow. You gather seed. It's an annual. It's a profound adaptogen. I have profound experiences with Indian goddesses and divinity. It's this whole other realm with this plant. Easy to harvest, easy to grow, and it really helps our mentation, our cognition, our heart. So it's a toss-up between rose and holy basil.
All right. Do you have an herb? For instance, Dr. Christopher had lobelia. That was his herb. Mm. So what is your herb?
Mm. You know, I love Dr. Christopher lobelia because so many people are so frightened of lobelia that I will teach classes simply on lobelia. Mm. So it can come back into its rightful place in the pantheon of our medicines. And, you know, I have to be honest, I don't have one herb. I feel that it moves through different time. So right now, during this time, with the last 2 years, I'd have to say it's a motherwort, because motherwort is a vasodilator. It's a relaxant. It helps with the heart. It helps with anxiety, palpitations. It's very cooling. And it is a bitter. So I see with the stress and anxiety of these last couple of years, digestive issues, anxiety, take small doses. You don't need large doses. It's a mint, so it grows a little too easily. Mm-hmm. I think it changes depending on what the needs are.
Right. I love your description of distilling spirits, especially the part of it being done in the imaginal realm.
It is that alchemy. It is that dream state. It is what some people might call the shamanic realm of that. But for me, the imaginal realm is our heart. I talk about Enrique Orbe and in some ways sitting with a plant, Stephen Buhner, love his work. The heart is the organ of perception. And more it's imagining with our heart. And we think imagination of more of a mind activity. We imagine, but it's more dream state. Mm-hmm. And dreaming with our hearts and sensing with our hearts. And because if we're looking at solutions, it's the imaginings. It's accessing an intelligence beyond our limitations. Mm. And so my limitations are what I've learned, what information I've taken in, and it's my past. And imaginal is reaching into the invisible. And I don't think we need entheogens or psychedelics or those plants, although I'm a huge proponent of using them as serious medicines. And I work a lot with vets, and I work a lot in our free clinic with unhoused people. And we've been doing some interesting studies with Johns Hopkins. But the imaginal realm is so accessible to us in the sense of what does my heart feel?
As you write, communicating cross species provides homeostasis, and within that, plants teach us how to be fully human.
that came to me through the writing, actually. The whole process of the book was fascinating in itself, because I really worked with the plant realm often. And so coming to that understanding, I really never articulated how plants help us to become human until the book. So, for example, say I take motherwort. Motherwort has a pattern. And so energetic herbalism is really based in patterns. So Chinese Ayurveda, you know, in some ways with earth and fire, these elements present the same pattern no matter what culture you're in. So to learn the patterns will help us to understand, well, what patterns my body need at this particular time. So motherwort holds many different patterns, but one, it's opening and it's dropping and it's relaxing, and it has a specificity to the heart. And so ideally, when we're working with plants, you take the plant and they're supposed to nudge us into who we really are. So when I take motherwort, it creates the pattern of, oh, it's this, it's like you're taking a breath, you're dropping down. And that when I take motherwort for a long enough period, and I know this, and I bring this back into my body, I don't need the plant. I don't take the herb. So in that way, that's one way that they hold patterns for us. And it teaches me, motherwort teaches me how to be in my heart, how to be relaxed, how to hold this. Cohosh has its own. Solomon's seal root helps us to make 90 degree changes. And so if I take this plant and I know I have to change, I bring this pattern in and it repeats itself. It's like bushwhacking, if you will. You know, if you walk a path long enough, that path becomes known. So when you take plants in this way, it helps me make that turn. It helps me have that volition to then make that change. Then I don't need that plant anymore.
You know, I wonder if you've ever prescribed a potted herb for someone to perhaps just keep in their house and sit with or something like that.
Oh, sure, of course. And one just clarification, herbalists don't prescribe. We're not licensed, and we fought really hard to stay unlicensed, but we'll recommend plants. And it's such a great statement, because I'll recommend people, instead of ingesting herbs in their garden, or just to go sit with that. And there are many potted herbs that will winter over. You know, sage, desert sage, we have to leave the certain natives to the indigenous people, and we can grow sage from seed, and we can bring that in a pot. And so I've brought that in, and I've had people sit with that plant. You can bruise it, and you can smell it. And any herb with volatile oils, you know, you don't really have to ingest. It's that breathing with it.
Yeah. Well, this is amazing. Thank you. And I guess I just have one more question for you. As you mentioned, your clinic. Tell us about your clinic.
So I have a 3-year clinical training program. And so in the third year, we run a free clinic, and they're seen by a student. It's all very professional. And then myself or another staff member is always there mentoring. And so that's offered to the clinic. And then the other clinic that we run, it's called Botanica Mobile Clinic. And this rose out of a dear friend of mine, Lorna Monobradoc, who has run this free clinic for years in Atlanta, Georgia, and has this incredible template. And so we just started showing up, offering, going into different communities, offering herbal care, free herbs. And then we've had certain incidents here in Virginia and Charlottesville of great trauma. And so, you know, in Richmond with Black Lives Matter and some of the movements, we've done jail support. So we bring herbs, we bring care packages, you know, bringing essential oils, just scents, and doing in some ways trauma work, and showing up. And we're deeply trained, because there's a lot involved there, but it's very, very simple herbs, but it's just this presence. I mean, literally giving a bag of lavender flowers to people in traumatic situations. kitchens or even in our shelters here. They absolutely love it. I mean, you walk in and it smells like lavender. And they're totally turned on and they're so grateful because they're like, look, nobody ever gives us organic. You know, we always kind of get the second. So we get great support. We're doing COVID has really changed it. We did COVID care packs. And so that's Botanica Mobile Clinic. And for people that are interested in that, I would highly recommend Laura's website because it's so much incredible information. And she's herbalista.org.
Kat Mayer's book, Energetic Herbalism, is a great add to any library. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are in the usual places. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.